Good evening. I'm Kevin. This will be our speakers meeting tonight. I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon Family Groups, and I'm delighted to be able to open this meeting.
Hi, Kevin.
We welcome you to the Fall Fellowship of the Spirit Al-Anon Family Group, and hope that you'll find in this fellowship the help and friendship we have been privileged to enjoy. We who live or have lived with the problem of alcoholism understand, as perhaps few others can. We too were lonely and frustrated, but in Al-Anon, we discover that no situation is really hopeless, and that it is possible for us to find contentment and even happiness, whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. We urge you to try our program. It has helped many of us find solutions that lead to serenity. So much depends upon our own attitudes, and as we learn to place our problems in its true perspective, we find it loses power to dominate our thoughts and our lives. The family situation is bound to improve as we apply the Al-Anon ideas. Without such spiritual help, living with an alcoholic is too much for most of us. Our thinking becomes distorted by trying to force a solution, and we become irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. The Al-Anon program is based on the 12 steps adapted from Alcoholics Anonymous, which we try little by little, one day at a time, to apply to our lives, along with our slogans and the Serenity Prayer. The loving interchange of help among members and the daily reading of Al-Anon literature thus makes us ready to receive the priceless gift of serenity. Anonymity is an important principle of the Al-Anon program. Everything that is said here in the group meeting and member to member must be held in confidence. Only in this way can we feel free to say what is in our minds and hearts, for this is how we help one another in Al-Anon. I've asked some of our Al-Ateens to help me with the opening reading of the 12 Steps and Traditions. So, Sid, could I get you to come up and read the 12 Steps for me, please? Start right here.
Okay. Because of their proven power and worth, AA's 12 steps have been adopted almost word by word by Al-Anon. They represent a way of life appealing to all people of goodwill, of any religious faith, or of none. Note the power of the very words. 1. We admitted that we are powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanageable. 2. Came to believe that the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7. Humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them. 9. Made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10. Continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong and promptly admitted it. 11. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will and for us and the power to carry that out. 12. Having a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to others and practice these principles in our affairs.
Thank you, Sid.
Thanks, Sid.
Michaela, right? Could I get you to come up and read the 12 traditions? From the Al-Ateen 12 traditions.
I can't.
There. Is that better?
I'm short.
Okay.
1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal progress for the greatest number depends on unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group.
Confidence.
Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism and a relative or friend. The teenage relatives of alcoholism, when gathered together for mutual aid, may call themselves an Alateen group, provided that, as a group, they have no other afflictions. 4. Each group should be anonymous, except in matters affecting other Alateen and Al-Anon family groups or AA as a whole. Each Alateen group has but one purpose, to help practice. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves and by encouraging and understanding the number of our immediate families. 6. Alateen, being a part of an Al-Anon family group, ought never be endorsed. Finance or lend our name to any outside enterprise. Less money, properties of
and prestige.
Oh my gosh, prestige divert us from our primary spiritual
aim.
Although a separate
entity
should always
cooperate.
Oh my gosh, cooperate with Alcoholics Anonymous. Every group ought to be fully self-supporting. Declining outside contributions. Eight. Alateen's 12 steps work should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. Our group, as such, ought never be organized, but we may have certain service boards or communities directly responsible for those they are. 10. Alateen's groups have no opinions on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attractions rather than promotion. We need always to maintain personal anonymity at the levels of press, radio, films, and TV. We need to guard these with special care, the anonymity of all AA members. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundations of all our traditions, even reminding us to place principles
over personalities.
Personalities.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Michaela.
I don't know about you, but I could have never done that at that age. Could we open this meeting now with a moment of silence, followed that by the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It gives me great pleasure. The Alateens are here in force tonight. I don't know if you've noticed that. It's awesome to see Alateens at all different functions. The recovery possibilities for them to have is tremendous. And Deanne is one of our Alateen sponsors from Salt Lake. Deanne, could I get you to introduce our wonderful speaker for this evening?
Hi, I'm Deanne.
Hi, Deanne.
I have the privilege, as Kevin said, to introduce our Alateen speaker. I've been an Alateen sponsor for about 4 years, and I've seen this young woman come into our group about a year and a half ago. And when she first came in, we had a trip to plan to Kanab for the fall assembly last year. And she immediately jumped right in, and I didn't know her too well. And she ended up in my room with three other girls. And we just had a wonderful experience. And what I've seen from her over the last year and a half is tremendous growth. Tremendous leadership coming out in her. She's one of the main people in our group now who will lead a meeting, who will offer to call someone or return a call to someone. She's had tremendous growth, and I'm just really, really proud of her. So I'd like to introduce Candace.
My name's Candace, and I'm a member of Alateen.
Hi, Candace.
Wow. I'm so grateful to be here. I never would have thought, you know, Alateen would bring me to a place where I can, you know, share my story, which is neat. And so I grew up in a family of alcoholics. Both my parents were sober longer than, you know, I've been alive, and I've never seen them drink, but, you know, there's still that alcoholic behavior, you know, whether the alcoholic is drinking or not. And, you know, I had to deal with that. My parents got a divorce when I was 10 years old. And I don't know, I decided to live with my dad, and things just started to change. I saw, you know, my dad's character defects come out, and I guess I hadn't noticed that, you know, parents have flaws too. You know, I always looked up to them, and there was a lot of trust I had with my parents. And after my parents got a divorce, things took a turn for the worse. And there was an instance where I was about, I'd say 11 or 12, and I had plans with one of my friends, and the plans didn't work out the way I thought they would, and my dad was really frustrated, and I noticed how he would get frustrated over small things, and then, you know, would build up, and eventually there was a lot of verbal abuse going on. And after a few years after my parents split up, my dad quit going to meetings. So he was what you'd call a dry drunk. And I had a lot of trouble dealing with it. I didn't know that my dad had a problem, an alcoholic problem. I didn't understand really what it was. And, you know, there came a time where I was fed up with the verbal abuse as well as the physical abuse. And I started getting into some trouble, and I hit my stage of rebellion. And I don't know, it was like I felt like I had nobody to turn to because I didn't trust my dad anymore. There was an instance where I got into some trouble with the police. And it had to do with drinking, and that was when my mother took me to an Alateen meeting. She suggested Alateen, and I thought, you know, if I go to this Alateen group, maybe I can, you know, change things. You know, I need some change in my life. I was sick of the old, you know, I felt afraid in my own home of my dad. And I was really lost. I didn't have a God. I didn't have a higher power. I didn't feel like, I felt really alone. And so it was really tough for me to dive into the Alateen program, but I knew that, you know, if I wanted things to change, I needed to, you know, do something different. And I really liked how my first Alateen meeting, I came home and I just cried. I didn't talk to anybody. I just sat and listened. I was really quiet. And I came home and cried, and I told my mom, you know, I want to go back. And it took a lot for me to get me in there, but I was so glad after that first meeting. I mean, things didn't, you know, get better right away, but I noticed how I had to start focusing on, you know, not letting an alcoholic's problems affect my life. I had to, you know, learn how to work around that and focus on myself and, you know, continue to better myself, even though things weren't perfect with my parents and my relationship with my parents. And I noticed how my behavior started to change, and my relationships with, you know, not only my parents, but my friends got better. I learned how to treat people, how to deal with people, how to respect people, and how to accept that not everybody is going to, you know, do what you want all the time. And that was tough for me because, you know, I mean, it's really easy to try and manipulate people and you know, wallow. I did a lot of wallowing in my own self-pity and denial. I felt bad for myself. I have an abusive dad, and I didn't know what to do about it. And Alateen really changed things for me. I now have kids my own age that I can call, that show up for me, that understand what I'm going through when I'm going through it. And, you know, I have the wonderful sponsors that, you know, they're obviously there every meeting, but, you know, they truly have helped me change my life. And, I'm forever grateful for that. And thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Candace. Boy, I don't know about you, but these Alateens just amaze me. You want to, kick your program in the butt a little bit? Sign up to be an Alateen sponsor. These kids are amazing. The recovery that they teach me when I get an opportunity to work with them is absolutely amazing. For our next... for our Al-Anon speaker, I'm going to turn that over to somebody that I trust in with everything I have, my new wife. Stana, would you please introduce our Al-Anon speaker?
Hi, I'm Stana. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I feel very, very privileged to be able to introduce this fine lady. I first met her many, many years ago. In fact, it was early on in my Al-Anon treatment. My youngest son was in a treatment center at Dayspring, and I was told I needed to go to Al-Anon, and the first meeting that I went to, this lady was there. And we've seen each other off and on in meetings over the years a lot. Some things that I know about Frances is she's been through a lot, a really, really lot, and came out looking wonderful. Holy cow. She helped start some of the Spanish-speaking meetings in the Salt Lake Valley, which I think is a big, big deal. I got to know her much better. She was in one of my meetings about 2 years ago, I guess. My sponsor at the time decided to sell her home in Taylorsville and move to Mesquite. And, you know, at first I thought, well, that'd be great. I can do the long-term sponsorship thing. Well, I couldn't. So I asked her to sponsor me, and she said, have you prayed about it? She has these questions all the time. Have you prayed about it? And I said, yes, I have. Numerous times. Okay, and then we had a little discussion on what our relationship was going to look like, because she's a very busy lady. She does a lot. Obviously, she broke her ankle. And through that discussion, we were able to decide that, yeah, it was going to work. And the really magical, cool thing about her, I spoke earlier on step two, and one of the things that I had on my notes that I didn't read that I was going to say is, in order for me to do my program the way I need to, I have to have a sponsor, and I have to work with that sponsor. And the reason that really works is because I can call her on the phone, and she may not answer the phone right away because she's really busy, but she always calls me back. And when she does, she'll say, okay, what's going on? And I tell her, and she goes, she'll think for a second, and she'll go, have you prayed about it? I was really struggling with detachment. And this was a few months ago. And she gave me some suggestions, but she said, you need to do two things. You need to read everything you can on detachment and stay detached, and you need to stay really close to your higher power. And she's very, very inspiring. And 5 minutes on the phone, she doesn't have to sponsor me any longer than that, because 5 minutes on the phone, she knows exactly what the problem is, what I need to do, and has lots of suggestions. But she never tells me what to do. She says, this is an experiment. Try this. We're going to experiment, and it always works. She is a wonderful person, and I love her dearly. Frances, it's all yours.
Do you want the chair?
Yeah, you could take this.
Okay. Well, my name is Frances, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. And I want to thank Bill for inviting me to be a speaker. He called me a couple of months ago before I hurt my foot and asked me if I would speak. And it's a real privilege to do that. And I want to thank Eric for the beautiful basket that he brought to my room. It was huge. It has a lot of stuff in it. It's really pretty. And it has lots of goodies. And Stan is just a wonderful woman. I've known her for a long time, and she said some really nice things, so thank you, Stan. She's a wonderful woman. There's a lot of wonderful people in this program, and she's one of them. But, you know, they say that we attract alcoholics as Al-Anons, and I'm going to give you an example. I was in a meeting about in the early 90s. Well, I was on my way to a meeting at the Alano Club in Salt Lake City. And it was probably about this time of the year. It was dark. And when you're walking up to the Alano Club, you can see the stairs. They leave the door open. You can see the stairs open and the light on to the AA room. And this drunk man walked up to me and he said, "Ma'am, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Sure." He said, "I'm looking for the Alano Club. Can you tell me where it is?" I said, "You're standing right in front of it." And he said, "Well, I have to go to a meeting." I said, "All you have to do is just walk up those stairs, and you can see the light. Just go in, and you'll be right there." He says, "Right here?" I said, "Yeah, this is the Alano Club." And he said, and I'm really scared. He said, "Will you walk with me in there?" And I said, "Okay." So he puts his arm out like this, and I said, no, I'm not going to be taking your arm." So we walk up the stairs, and I said, "Okay, this is the room." There were probably about 140 people there. And I start walking into the Al-Anon room. They're kind of attached. And all of a sudden, he yelled, "Hey, ma'am, will you wait for me after the meeting?" And so Jerry Kay stood up, and she said, "Don't worry, folks, she attracts them." So I do. I attract alcoholics. So that's a little bit of history. I'm kind of at rock bottom Al-Anon, and you'll soon see that in just a few minutes. So I'm going to go back and give you a little bit of my history from my childhood. I was born in southern Colorado, around Durango. In fact, I was born in a hospital in Durango. Back in the mountains, we were kind of Hispanic hillbillies back then. My family had been in those mountains for about 400 years. And my uncles, you know, they had their own still, probably built them during Prohibition, don't know. But they drank out of, you know, if they were in public, they drank out of a paper sack, and they drank out of mason jars sometimes, this clear liquid. So, you know, it was just part of my culture. Drinking was part of my culture. They made their own wine. They were from Spanish-speaking communities. And we left there when I was 3 years old. I was born Catholic. And, you know, I really believe that when I was born, I was a perfect child, one of God's children. I think that we all are. And I think it's through God's grace that any of us have a seat in this room tonight. Because it's not because of what we know why we're here. It's because God's grace has brought us here. And I really believe that. Anyway, my parents moved to Salt Lake City when I was 3. And when I was 5 years old, we went back to Colorado every year of my life. I spent my summers there. But when I was 5 years old, I was a little flower girl in a wedding. And the Catholic Church, they would sometimes hide their problem priests up in the mountains. So they would put them back in the hills back there where, you know, they couldn't, where people wouldn't know about what they were doing. And anyway, he had been drinking, and we had been doing some practicing. Anyway, I ended up alone with this priest, and there was some overt abuse that took place. It's not part of Al-Anon, but it's part of my story. And that's where I started this dark path of alcoholism. And that same summer, we had been at my aunt's home, and they were cooking some things, and
I was a curious little girl, probably not well at the time either because of what had happened. But there was this big, they had a big kettle on the stove, and it had some lard and some flour in it. They were making a roux to do some thickening, and I had poured that on my face. My father said my skin just peeled off of my face and onto my hand. So, you know, when I started school, I was already a strange child because abuse will make you a strange and weird person. And then I had this malady about me. I had this burn on the side of the face and hand. And so I was a strange child. You know, I started down that dark road of alcoholism. And then I began, you know, my molding as in alcoholism through my parents. My father, he would drink, and he was a welder. He'd get paid every 2 weeks, and so I started getting my Al-Anonism, my molding from my mother. So my father, he would get paid, and he'd drink. You know, after on Friday night after work, he'd go get drunk, and my mother would wait for him, but she wouldn't. My mother never said anything bad about my father when she was waiting for him. We would all wait for him to come home, and you know, my dad, my mother, she just sat in this cold, dark silence. She was very angry, but she was very cold about it. And one night in particular, my father pulled in and he passed out in the driveway. And I ran out, you know, to the car to see why he wasn't coming in. And I thought he had died. He was passed out on the steering wheel. I went back in the house, started yelling, you know, Dad's dead. And they all started laughing at me. Because he had passed out. And, you know, I just remember feeling a lot of shame about that, being ashamed that I had felt, you know, that I had found him and thought he was dead. But so I started to understand, you know, I started to learn how to do this thing called, you know, the silent treatment, because my mother was really good at it. And my father, what he would do is he would do one of two things. He would either buy her love back or he would turn us against her. So my father would turn his behavior onto my mother because my mother really was the angry one, and she wasn't the nice one. So, you know, she always became the bad person. So I started to learn how to behave this way, you know, how to become an Al-Anon by watching my family. And, there were times when my father, you know, he would spend a lot of that paycheck, and then before those next 2 weeks would come up, we would be hungry because there wouldn't be enough money. And so, you know, that's I just kind of learned that that's the way it was. That's the way that we behaved. And this went on for a lot of years in my life. Whenever we'd have big family parties, you know, everyone would drink, and they would drink a lot. And there was always a lot of inappropriate behavior. See, and I learned a lot of inappropriate things way too early in my life. And that's how I started to become, you know, an Al-Anon in training. Anyway, my parents moved to Seattle, Washington, and they took us to Seattle during the Boeing crunch. And my father, he still continued with his drinking. You know, he'd drink Saturday night. My mom would still be waiting for him, you know, and we'd go through that whole thing. It was just something that we did over and over and over again. You know, Dad, he'd get the silent treatment, and she always had really nice things. My mom always had really nice things, even though we were poor. But, you know, that's when my father got back into her good graces. And anyway, my mother, when I was 16, she got pregnant, and my father had been out. You know, he'd been doing his thing. And she went into labor, and she was so mad at my dad, she took the bus to the hospital to have the baby. So, you know, I just started learning these things, you know. I just learned to be self-will just by watching my mother. My mother was a very controlling woman, and she was very angry, and, you know, we always did everything that she said. She was really a wonderful woman because the things that I do today, I really believe it's because of my mother's strengths. And I was able to get through that in Al-Anon. And I did a lot of therapy. I did 7 years of therapy. There's a page in the ODAP book that say that some of us have to do that, and I'm just one of those people in Al-Anon that had to do a lot of therapy. Anyway, we finally came back to Salt Lake City, but before we came back, something happened, and I didn't really understand this. I did a fifth step about 7 years ago on a thorough 6 and 7 and really started to understand my behavior, and I started taking responsibility for my actions. Because, you know, in Al-Anon, you can go to therapy for many, many years. You can figure out, you know, here's all the pieces of your life, but you never have to take responsibility for your actions. But in Al-Anon, you know, we have to take responsibility, and that's why it works. Anyway, I was walking home from school, and there was this Afro-American kid back in the 60s that had a crush on me. And my mother was quite prejudiced. But, you know, I wasn't really interested in him. We were walking home from school. A girlfriend was with me, and we're walking down the street, and I see my mother watching us. You know, she's there at the window, and I can just see her. She's just watching us come down the street. And sure enough, when I walk in the door, she's just livid, you know. He went his way, and me and my girlfriend stood there, and she said, you know, what do you think the neighbors are going to think with you walking down the street like that? And, you know, I was okay. I was just okay that day. And all of a sudden, it just dawned on me that my mother, you know, I was in control and she was out of control. And I learned how to have control over my mother through men, which was not a good thing, you know. That was not a good thing. But that's where it started. We went back to Salt Lake City. I didn't want to go. I was doing really well in school, and she wouldn't let me stay because I did a lot of work for my mother. The only way that I got my mother's love was to clean the house. And so, you know, I would cook and clean for her, and then she would not be so hard on me. And I did not want to come back to Utah. But I came, and, you know, I got pregnant because my mother did not like him. He had this 1957 Chev with white leather seats, and he didn't have a job. And she would always say to me, you know, where does he work? And who cared where he worked? He had a nice car. So anyway, you know, I ran away from home. He was an acid freak, and acid made him really hostile. And it was not a good deal. We ended up divorced. I had two children from him. And then I started my first geographical. I went back to Seattle, Washington. And I have this pattern. My pattern for How I Choose Men was written by Carly Simon. And she said, you know, the song, he walks into a party like he's walking onto a yacht. All the girls want to be his girlfriend. You know, and he watches himself walk by. And he's out with another man's wife, you know, doing things he shouldn't be doing. And that's exactly the way that I chose my men, the husbands that I had. Anyway, so I got divorced, went to Seattle, and actually when I met my first husband, I met him through some girlfriends, and they said, oh, look, there's him. And, you know, and there he was, you know, the girls were all talking about him. So that happened with my second husband. We went to a dance one night, and he walked in, and all the girls were saying, ah, there he is, you know. And then, of course, I married him, and he was an alcoholic, and it didn't go well, and I had such a bad deal with the first husband. You know, I came back to Salt Lake City for my second geographical, and then I got married again to the man that brought me. He's not my current husband, but to the man that brought me to this program. And he was an alcoholic, and he was also a drug dealer. And so my life got really interesting, and it got really bad, but it didn't get bad until I got to Al-Anon. So with him, you know, I started to, had a horrible obsession with him. And it was really difficult because I couldn't divorce him because he was number three, and I wasn't 30 years old. And I got to tell you, I didn't think that that was odd for a long time in recovery, that I had been married three times before I was 30. So anyway, he would party. He loved to drink, and he'd go out on Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, and he'd come home Sunday morning because he was a good Catholic. He was, you know, that was just his way. And so, you know, I was really quite obsessed, and I started having, I'd wait for him. You know, I'd learned how to wait. So I would wait for him. I'd keep his dinner warm in the oven. And we started doing what I call the dance to death. he would call in the evening and he would say, I'll be home in 20 minutes. I'm having a few drinks, I'll be home in 20 minutes. So, you know, I'd go back and I'd start waiting. And pretty soon, you know, that was at 7 o'clock. Pretty soon it was 10 o'clock. And then it was 11 o'clock. And by then, you know, the rage is building and the anger. And then the phone would ring. And it would be him. And he would say, hi, I'm sorry. You know, I'll be home in 20 minutes. And by, so, you know, I'd hang up the phone. And 20 minutes would go by. He wasn't there. It would be midnight, and then the obsession would, by then I would just be angry, and the obsession would set in. And, you know, I did a lot of things. You know, I put my nose up to the window. I went looking for him on a 10-speed at 2 o'clock in the morning one night because he had my car. I didn't get very far. And, you know, I did a lot of checking on him. I did a lot of waiting. One night he came in, and I was waiting for him at the door, and he said, you know, he'd walk in the door and I'd start doing my Al-Anon thing, start complaining about where he'd been, why he doesn't come home, and blah, 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 blah. And he said, oh, good night, Irene. And I started pounding his chest saying, don't call me your girlfriend's names. And he said, it's the same, Francis, it's the same, you know. So I was just crazy. We did this for a lot of years, probably for, you know, the first 4 years of our marriage. 5 years, maybe six. I can't even remember. We would play this game of, you know, he would make the phone call. It never dawned on me not to answer the phone. I just would always answer the phone because I'm a good little Al-Anon, right? You always answer the phone. Sometimes I just wish he was dead. He would come home. You know, I'd worry that he was going to die, and then he'd show up, and then I'd be angry because he was still alive. And I was just nuts. But, you know, I didn't sleep very much because he would come in like at 3 or 4, 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go to work, and I had to get rid of the horror of the night. And the way that I did that was with makeup. And I was really obsessed with the dark circles I had under my eyes. I can remember how important it was every morning I'd sit in front of that mirror, and I didn't do it because I wanted to look good. I did it because I didn't want anyone to know that I, you know, that I was never sleep, that I wasn't sleeping. I was just having a terrible, terrible time. Became a terrible insomniac over that during those years. And, you know, we did a lot of things. Some nights he would pull in, and, you know, he would turn the car off. So he knew I'd be waiting for him. He'd turn the car off and roll, and I can remember, I can hear the tires against the ground. You know, he's sneaking in, and I'm listening for him to, you know, to get in there. But, boy, it was just horrible. We just had that, I had that obsession with him. And my job, I worked for a big corporation. I stayed with them for 35 years. But they had chosen me around, you know, the time just before Al-Anon, they had chosen me to participate in this huge deal that they did. They had hired a man by the name of Hunsaker to come in, and he had done like the 10 steps to successful managing or something. Anyway, there were two non-management people that were invited to the seminars, and I was one of them. So for a while there, during these seminars, you know, God, they were teaching me things about living, and God, I started to just hit a bottom. Because I was living this lie and, you know, pretending like I wasn't. I would go to work and I'd pretend like I wasn't living this lie. And at the end of these seminars, they had a big breakfast one morning. And I was supposed to be there at 7:30 in the morning. And he had been out. It was 6, you know, he had the car. I didn't have a car. And anyway, he rolled in. And I had gotten up, did my thing with my makeup. You know, had a nice dress on, went out to the car, and he was loaded, and he drove me to the Hilton Hotel and dropped me off. And, you know, I got into that place, and I couldn't walk in there. I just couldn't. I started to cry. And so I just left. I caught the bus home, changed my clothes, and went to work. And, you know, my boss came in at 10 o'clock in the morning, and she said, you in my office. And I thought for sure they were going to fire me. And something happened that morning. I just decided I was going to tell the truth. And so I told her the truth. I told her I was living with a man who was a drug dealer and that he was drinking and using all the time. And I couldn't sleep and I was crazy. And She made me an appointment to see the corporate psychologist, and she was the psychologist from hell. And she did not like Al-Anons. I went into her office, and I told her about him, and she told me I had to go to Al-Anon. I can remember thinking, yeah, I'm sure that's going to fix our problems. So I went back to work, and they said, did you make another appointment? And I said, no. And they said, well, you have to, because if you want your job, you're going to continue, you know, with this going to treatment. So I go back. I make my next appointment. She said, did you go to an Al-Anon meeting? And I said, no. And she said, you know, if you don't go to an Al-Anon meeting, Frances, I am not going to see you, she said, because you're untreatable. And she said, you know, if Frances, I want to tell you, if there was an Al-Anon institution in the state of Utah or within our 14-state region, she said, you would be there. She said, but there's not. But she said, you will go to Al-Anon or I will not see you. So I didn't go. I didn't go. I had the packet there. I didn't throw the packet away. That was kind of odd. I think about that. I didn't throw the packet away. And anyway, one morning at 6 o'clock in the morning, it was a Saturday morning, a lady knocked at my door. And I looked out at her. And I knew she wasn't there to have coffee with me. And I opened the door and she said, you know where your husband is, Frances? And I said, I thought, no, and I'm sure you're going to tell me. And she did. That's what got me to my first Al-Anon meeting. And, you know, when I went to that meeting, I just felt okay. I went to my first Al-Anon meeting, and I can't tell you really what happened. I just believe it was the language of the heart. And so I started to go to Al-Anon because I liked it. I started to feel a little better. I didn't feel quite so alone because, you know, when you're living in that situation, I started to isolate quite a bit and just really didn't have anybody to talk to. And, you know, I just, I cried a lot. And I thought I was sad, but I found out I was just really rageful and angry. And the only way that it could come out was through tears. Anyway, you know, things would get worse before they ever got better. And God's timing of getting me to this program really made a huge difference. I met a lady by the name of Louise B., and she was my first Al-Anon sponsor. She came up to me, she gave me an ODAT, and she took my number, and she called me. And she would call me and see how I was doing, and I would, you know, tell her what was going on. And she did this really wonderful thing for me. She would talk about steps 1, 2, and 3 and never call them steps 1, 2, and 3. So we would talk about what I was upset about, and we would talk about my powerlessness over what was going on in my home and the drugging and you know, the people that were coming and going. And then we would talk about what I could do. And then she would ask me, you know, if I'd clean my house. You know, she started making me do things and live in today. And she did with that to me all of the time. Louise saved my life because she gave me a foundation for this program that has never changed. She absolutely put the idea of what step 1, 2, and 3 is all about, and she made me live those three steps. You know, there was a lot of things that I had to do. I had to say the Serenity Prayer a lot during the day because I was just crazy. I just, you know, I was having such a difficult time and didn't know whether I should leave him or stay. That was my big deal. You know, should I go? Should I stay? Some days my heart would say to go and my head would say to stay. And then it was just the opposite. You know, I had this inner battle. And one of the reasons that I wouldn't go is because of her. And I wasn't going to let them get over on me. So I was going to make it easy for them. So I just continued to torture myself by staying in the marriage. And, you know, I got crazy in Al-Anon. Those first 3 years were just not, I didn't have a lot of wellness. I had monitoring equipment at work. And one day I barged into his line and listened to his conversation. And I didn't like what I heard. So I called Kathy S. in Al-Anon, and she said, Frances, do you remember that meeting that we talked about self-hatred? And I said, yeah. I'm like, oh, gosh, you know, I just hate this. You know, why are they telling me these things? The psychologist would say things to me like this, Frances, what is it about you that makes you think you have to be with someone like that? And, you know, I would just think, you know, what? you think I like this? I said that. Do you think I like this? And she said, yeah, I think you do, Frances. And, you know, it took me a lot of years to figure out what she was trying to tell me. And we had a lot of problems. He went from, he loved cocaine, and eventually he went to heroin. And when he went to heroin, large amounts of money started to disappear. And I would get calls from the people who were supplying him. And, you know, they would look for him. They would come slowly. They would come to the door, and then they'd go away and ask for him. They'd come to the door, and then they'd go away. And then this one night I got a call, and the man said, we're looking for your husband. And I said, well, you know, I don't know where he is. I rarely see him. He's always gone. And he said, you know, you have small children in your home, and he owes us a lot of money. So the next time that he arrived at home, because he would disappear for days at a time, I told him, I said, look, we have three vehicles in this home. If you don't take care of this business, if the man comes again, I'm giving him all the keys, I'm giving him all my jewelry, all the money that I have, or you take care of it. And he did. But we had quite a few of those situations before we divorced, and it got really scary. I'd go to my father-in-law's house and stay some weekends because I was too afraid to be at home with my children. And, you know, I just had that battle, that horrible, horrible battle. Should I go or should I stay? And this was the problem. You know, I thought, he's sick. You know, he's a sick man. You're going to leave a sick man? And then, you know, was it sickness or was it evil? You know, I had to make that distinction before I could go. And eventually, you know, I was able to do that. But, and, you know, and I prayed, and I had to work the slogans, and I had to make phone calls, and I had to rely on the program, and I had to do what I was told, and I had to drive differently. Some nights when I'd come home from a meeting, I didn't want to see if he was, you know, in one of the places that he hung out, because then I would just be obsessed for the night. So I started to drive home differently. I would take different routes. You know, I just kept trying those things. And you know what I did one night? I just stopped answering the phone. I just unplugged the phone and I went to sleep. I thought, conference, why didn't you just unplug the phone 3 years ago? You would have slept a lot better. But, you know, I mean, you know, you don't think about those things when you're obsessed. When you're crazy, you're not thinking about not answering the phone. You're thinking about keeping the, you know, the obsession going. And, you know, so I had to try a lot of things. And finally, he went into treatment. And we really hadn't had any kind of relationship with each other for quite almost a year, I would say, or eight months, because it's just not fun to have a relationship with somebody who is using heroin. They don't smell very good. But anyway, he got out of treatment, and we decided we would give it one more try. And, you know, I just couldn't have children. I had two boys, and then I never had children. And I didn't have to take any contraceptives. This one night, for some reason, I got pregnant. And you know, my doctor gave me some choices, but I couldn't live with the choices. So I just decided to keep the baby. And when I had her a year later, something happened to me. I was, you know, I had worked my program and worked it and worked it and worked it and decided that I was just going to do the best that I could with what I had. And I went to the grocery store one night, and it was raining. I remember the night really well because something happened to me that evening. And I pulled up, and he was there. And when he saw me, he drove away, and I already had an idea what was going on. And so I went into the store, and I did what Al-Anon told me to do. I just put one foot in front of the other. Went in, did my business, and when I got home, he was there, and, you know, something changed inside of me. It was like Bill W. talks about. I had this spiritual awakening, and the obsession, was gone, and I just knew that he was incapable of telling the truth. And I also did what Al-Anon told me to do. Al-Anon told me that if I was going to leave, that I had to do it when things were good, not when they were bad, and I waited for the time to be right. And one morning I asked him if he would just let me go. Because he was a powerful man. When we went out together, you know, there was always someone watching over me. If we went to a club, there was always a goon seated next to me. And so he said that he would let me go. And I made enough money through my job for Thanksgiving in December to move on, and I was able to get my own apartment. The hard part about leaving is I had two sons, and one of them stayed. I couldn't get him to go with me, and he was left behind. So I started this new life, and I was doing okay. I couldn't get money from him. My sponsor told me, she said, "Frances, I want you to do something." She said, "I want you to live off of the money that you make and live within your means. And if he gives you any kind of child support, I want you to think of it as a gift." And, you know, that helped me so much, because then I just didn't have to be crazy about him not giving me money. So I learned to live within my means. And I started my service work. This is where I started service. I was an Alateen sponsor for 6 years. You know, I helped, was part of the first Al-Anon conference, worldwide conference. I got to be a participant in that during this time. I met my fourth husband. And he was in the program. But as an odd thing happened to me, I went into what I call a spiritual constipation in my recovery. And if you've ever suffered from it, you'll know what it's like. It's when you go to meetings and you can't, you know, you're not hearing the message anymore. The words are just words. I would read pages, and they were just pages. And that became a real difficult marriage. And that was my part in it. You know, I was doing a lot of service work. I spoke at two conferences in Spanish. I did the Spanish-speaking meetings. Did a lot of PI. I did a lot of public information, loved public information, went to schools, we did radio, we did a lot of service work. And I think that that's what got me through that marriage. We ended up getting a divorce, and he passed away, and my mother and him passed away within a short time of each other. And, you know, that was really hard when my mother died, even though we had made peace, even though my mother and I had fought for so many years, we made peace in this program because of the gift of recovery. And, you know, I did some fourth steps. I'm telling you, the fourth step was hard. My first fourth step was so hard. It was hard to write that piece of paper. It took a few years for me, maybe 5-7 years for me to realize that, you know, the fourth step wasn't that difficult because it was just me and a piece of paper. It was the fifth that I should have been afraid of. And I did a fifth step. And a lot of those early four steps were like confessions. You know, I was talking about things that I had stolen and affairs that I had had. And they were just confessions. I really wasn't learning about what my problem or my pattern was. And so I didn't know. I really didn't work a 6 or 7 back then. I did a lot of service work. I just, you know, I was still working the steps. I would read every day and had a good sponsor. Joni H. was my sponsor at the time. And a brilliant woman in Al-Anon. And he passed away, and then my mother died, and I kind of let go of service because I just, you know, it just got hard. And Joni H., she said, I go to Crested Butte quite often. I've been going for almost 20 years. They have a big conference there that runs for a week. And Joni H., the year that he died, I couldn't go to meetings when he died, and I was so angry at AA. It was just angry. I was just angry at AA. But God brought the fellowship to me because I was working in 2002. We had, you know, the Olympics, and I worked for the Olympics for 2 years through my corporation. And, you know, I was part of the drug and alcohol program with my corporation by then. And they brought program people to Utah, and those people took care of me. They called on me. They checked on me. We had meetings without me knowing it, you know, just on the sly. We'd go for a walk, and they were, you know, doing their 12-step work with me. And Joni H., she told me I needed to get to Crested Butte. So I drove myself to Crested Butte that summer, and I heard everything I needed to hear for me to get back into recovery the way that I needed to. And then I met my husband. I met him at Crested Butte. He's a wonderful man. We did a workshop together, and I liked him. He wasn't my pattern. I didn't know my pattern when I met him, but he wasn't my pattern. He was just, we sat down together before that workshop and we talked, and he kept making fun of me and teasing me, and I just liked him. You know, I just kind of I liked the person that he was. And so a couple of years later, I did a thorough fifth step and found out, you know, that pattern, that he walked into a room, and he didn't walk into the room. He was just another person. One of the problems that I have with relationships is that after about 2 years, well, you know, I never bring Francis into the relationship. I bring the person that I think you need me to be. And then 2 years later, I'm so tired of being this, you know, this person that I have to be myself, and then things don't go well after that. And so, you know, I had to learn that about me. I had to learn what it was about Francis, like the psychologist had said. What is it about you, Francis, that makes you think that you need to be with someone like him? And it had nothing to do with him. After I did that fifth step with my sponsor, I did a thorough 6 and 7, and I'm telling you, I did those two steps for 2 years, and I learned so many things. I started to pray about having judgments about those husbands, and about them being husbands and fathers, trying to let go of my judgment of that. And a lot of really wonderful things came through, some things that I'm not really proud of. One of them was with my youngest son, and what I learned was that I had hated his father through him, and it was real difficult. That was a real hard thing for me to come to terms with. And by then it was too late, because he was already on his way to alcoholism. He's not in the program, but I think he's been sent to the program. We don't talk, and I'm sure that this is something that God is eventually going to have to take care of. But I pray a lot about that, because I know that, you know, that's something that God's going to have to help me with. But it's just part of, you know, what I was back then. I'm like I said, I'm not proud of that, but it's what happened. And a lot of wonderful things have happened in the program for me. I talk about, you know, the difficulties and, you know, the things that I had to learn and the relationships that I had. But I worked for 35 years. I wanted to go to school those years. You know, I was the mother that took care of everything. I was afraid of getting fired. I did everything the psychologist told me. And then 10 years after she sent me to Al-Anon, they didn't need a corporate psychologist anymore. And we went to dinner and she said, you know, Francis, I need to make an amends to you. And I said, okay. And she said, you know, when you first came into my office, she said, I thought you were the craziest woman I had ever met in my life. She said, and I didn't believe a word you told me. And she said, I just want to apologize for, you know, for that. And anyway, she was, you know, it was just one of those things where things keep coming back to you in the program. I had a lot of God things happen. And so I worked for 35 years in this corporation. I was able to keep my job. You know, I had a lot of really good jobs. I worked with a lot of people. Had a lot of envy about people being able to go to school and work. I couldn't. I had two boys at home and then a daughter. You know, at the end of my career in 2008, I got offered a lot of money to leave. And I was able to go to school for 3 years. Back in the 90s, my aunt, she's a folk artist with the Salt Lake Arts Council. And I just, she would kind of rescue me from the difficulties of my home when I was a child. So I would go help her when she was working with the Arts Council. And I did an apprenticeship with her, and then I became a folk artist because of my aunt just doing one of those things that the program talks, you know, talks to us about, making, you know, going back and doing what we need to do with people. Well, I went to school, and I didn't know what I wanted to do after I retired from my corporation. I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, and I started going to school, and I decided I would take a yoga class. I would take it Tuesday and Thursday at 7:30 in the morning, but what I found was that when I practiced yoga, that towards the end, you know, my days were better. So, you know, I kind of looked at their yoga program, and, you know, I'm in my 50s, and I decided I would take their teacher training program. And took my first class and with a lot of young people, and you know, I just kind of hung in there and was able, and I got my certificate, and I went to I thought I would teach people 60 and over, and I volunteered at a senior center to work, just work with women for free. And when I got my certificate, I started getting phone calls. And before, I have more work in yoga than I've ever wanted in my life. I teach 8 classes a week. And I guess what I'm trying to tell you is that there's promises in this program that you'll have a life that you never thought you could have. You know, my husband, we did another workshop a couple of years ago, and we decided that we would try a relationship. And you know, we eventually got married, and we pray together. And things aren't perfect, but, you know, we have this daily prayer, and we make our bed together every morning until I hurt myself. And, you know, it seems like when we pray, we can work things out. There's nothing big ever really gets out of hand. It's really been a nice gift, and I'm just really grateful for my husband. He's he's just somebody I just didn't think I could ever be with. When I first met him that many years ago, back in 2003 or 4, whatever it was, I didn't think that him and I had anything in common. We have a lot in common. And, you know, before I go, I want to tell you about my mother. My mother, when I was the third daughter born out of 7 children, and you know, she was depressed when she had me. And so we had a lot of difficulties, my mother and I. And she couldn't take care of me, and there were these 4 women, sisters, that used to take care of me. And when I was between the ages of, from birth to the time I turned 3, these women actually did a lot. They took care of me. My mother couldn't love me. She couldn't take care of me because of her depressions. And then after I had started walking that dark road of alcoholism, you know, she just really didn't like me, which is okay. You know, I've made peace with that. But I had to work through my higher power stuff. Was really hard. You know, if you've ever been abused by the clergy, it makes spirituality almost impossible. I mean, I knew that there was a God out there, but I didn't think that God loved me. And the one thing that I learned from that 5th step was that I had no self-worth. And, you know, eventually I just didn't feel like I was a worthy person. And anyway, you know, every time I'd meet up with these women, they would tell me about my childhood. And they'd tell me how they would take care of me. That happened a lot. Well, one of the women died this last year. And the morning that she died, I had this dream about her illness, you know, that was taking her life. And what I found was that day, what God told me that day was that, you know, God's love came through those women. It didn't come through my mother. And it didn't have to come through my mother, because it doesn't matter what kind of love you have. When you have the love of God, it doesn't matter where you come from or where you've been. You will know that God loved you when you start to understand that it was God's love that got you through everything that you ever did. I didn't need the love of my mother because I already had God's love. I just didn't know that. I fought it for years. For years, I hated my mother. I had to, you know, we had to have our little come to Jesus session. And anyway, that's the story of my life and my recovery. And I just want to thank you for allowing me to share my story with you.
Thank you, Francis. What an amazing evening. By group conscious, the Fellowship of the Spirit Conference does not close each meeting with the Lord's Prayer. Instead, we encourage that this whole conference be treated with an attitude of continuous prayer. And we will then say the Lord's Prayer together at the close of this conference on Sunday. Would everyone please help me to close this meeting by joining hands for a moment of silence? Let us share our spiritual experiences and strengths with each other so that we can grow together in greater understanding and love.